I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A state auditor rebuffed, a county commission involved in a lawsuit with the sheriff's office, disgruntled employees and citizens who don't feel heard. That's a situation in Clay County, Missouri these days. Today we check in with reporters covering the saga there to get the latest and to ask how Clay County can get back on track. And I don't know about you, but with all that and the impeachment proceedings, I could use something a little lighter. One of my favorite music historians, Mark Myers, is back with the stories behind some of the most swingin' holiday songs. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The drumbeat of controversy continues unabated in Clay County. The latest just took place yesterday when an assistant Clay County administrator was not allowed to answer questions from state auditors, even though those auditors had a subpoena in hand. The state auditor is attempting to review county spending and procedures after citizens demanded the review through a petition drive last year. County commissioners then sued to stop the auditor from conducting the audit, but a court in October ruled on behalf of the auditor. Meantime, there's another lawsuit over whether the county can underfund the jail that some say is a move in retaliation for an investigation the sheriff conducted. All this is costing taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars. With us to talk about the troubles up in Clay County, Aviva Okeson-Haberman is KCUR's Missouri reporter. She just finished a two-part series on Clay County that can be found at kcur.org. Aviva, nice to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Matt Fleener is also here. He's an investigative reporter and anchor at KMBC-TV. He's been reporting on Clay County for months. Matt, nice to have you too. Good morning.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
Well, Aviva, I've covered government for a long time, and I've never seen a series of actions quite like this. I mean, Commissioners Gene Owen and Luann Ridgway are balking at subpoenas. They're filing lawsuits. They're opposing this citizen demand for an audit. It's really nothing short of breathtaking here.
Yeah, I think breathtaking is a really good word to kind of sum up what's going on. And there's a lot going on, as you kind of covered in the intro. I mean, I think one of the things that's just really interesting is how many citizens are upset with what's going on. You know, more than 9,000 citizens signed off on the petition. And a lot of people are really frustrated with some of the roadblocks that the commission has put up. And the idea behind this this audit is really just to kind of uncover what is going on in Clay County.
Matt, is a breathtaking a word you might use too?
Oh, absolutely.
And no doubt
about it.
No question about that.
No doubt about it. I've covered City Hall in Austin, Texas before, you know, the hotbed of Texas politics and that kind of thing. That doesn't even compare to what's going on here in
Clay County. Is county government up there still able to function? Is it like Congress getting, I guess Congress arguably still doing some things even with impeachment going on, but is anything else happening in Clay County right now?
The meetings are happening, right? The county commission meetings are happening. You've got the county clerk, the recorder of deeds. You've got all these offices that are still working. The collector, of course, is still collecting tax money. But the pace at which the meetings are happening is very slow. And you have commission meetings, even to set an agenda sometimes can take up to 30, 40 minutes just to set the agenda.
Because there's so much disagreement.
So much disagreement about what should actually just be on the county commission agenda.
So we're all in agreement here that this is pretty unusual stuff.
Yeah, what's happening. Yeah, there's, like you mentioned, there's a split vote on the agenda. It's a 2-to-1 vote most times on...
Which is usually a very routine kind of thing.
It's a routine type of thing. There's a split vote on whether or not to go to an executive session. So these are just kind of like, you know, the basic, like you mentioned, the basic votes, not even policy decisions.
No, Aviva, and you've written about this, there's not even a public comment period that's allowed during commission meetings. Those haven't been in place for more than 2 years. So can citizens even address their elected commissioners?
So that's been replaced by this monthly comment period that happens Friday at 4 p.m. in the courthouse. where the county spokeswoman writes down concerns. So citizens say, you know, they want to be able to go to a commission meeting and address the commissioners directly at this public comment period. Commissioners, if they show up, can't speak to the citizens directly. They would have to go, you know, outside of the meeting itself.
So just to be clear, these public sessions then are at 4 o'clock Friday afternoons.
Right.
And oftentimes the commissioners aren't even there.
Yeah. I've gone to two. Commissioner Jerry Nolte was at one, but the other two commissioners weren't. Now, during meetings themselves, citizens can talk about items that are specifically on the agenda. And what they say has to be really narrowly tailored to that. If they, you know, start talking about something that's not on the agenda, they debate could be shut down. Or if they bring up specific concerns with commissioners, debate could be shut down.
What's all this about? Why is there even a controversy over public comments at commission meetings, Matt?
It's because the public is speaking out so much against a couple of these commissioners, Lou Anne Ridgway and Gene Owen. There is just an overwhelming number of people that show up to voice their concerns at the way that both Lou Anne Ridgway and Gene Owen have voted there on the county commission. And I think that speaks to it speaks to a lot of obstruction that a lot of people have said is going on by these county commissioners. But at the same time, they have the power, right? They have the power in that 2-to-1 vote over Commissioner Nolte, who is, by the way, the presiding commissioner. But being the presiding commissioner doesn't mean much if you only have one vote.
And this is a little unusual, too, because if I understand right, Gene Owen is a Democrat. Lou Anne Ridgway is a Republican, a longtime state senator in Missouri. I used to cover her back in the day in Jefferson City. So it's kind of unusual pairing here that's going on.
Yeah, they're in lockstep together on most votes. There's a lot of debate on when they even take the votes, right? When they even take some votes to move ahead with the lawsuits, to move ahead with appealing the sheriff's lawsuit to the Supreme Court now. When did that vote happen? I asked Lou Anne Ridgway yesterday. I still haven't heard back on when that even happened. And so there's a lot of question on when some of these votes are happening. A lot of them may be happening in executive session. And that's the other thing, too. They'll call some of these meetings at odd times, right? There's generally commission meetings every 2 weeks, but sometimes they'll call commission meetings with 24 hours notice on a random Tuesday and show up and take some sort of a vote in executive session. So the citizens just have all kinds of questions on when their government is actually making decisions for them.
We're talking here about how upset some citizens are, Aviva, but again, you've written in a story just the other day that even other county officials in Clay County consider county government up there to be dysfunctional and full of hostility. What are those critics, people who actually work in the government, what are they saying to you?
Yeah, so the collector, assessor, auditor, and clerk say there's been kind of this shift in duties in the government where assistant county administrators are taking on a bigger role, and that is kind of an underlying factor to some of the issues that we're seeing right now. Mm-hmm. So an example of this would be the custodian of records duty. So if you want to get, you know, documents from your government, you used to go to the clerk. But in 2017, that was shifted to county administrators. So the concern is that, you know, you're requesting documents about the commission and administrators are under the commission. So Commissioner Jerry Nolte said, well, it's kind of like the fox watching the hen house.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Well, if our listeners, maybe those who live in Clay County, want to join our conversation with their thoughts about what's going on up there. And just for the record, we've tried to get Commissioners Ridgway and Owen on the show and have not been successful yet. But our number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Matt, let's bring our listeners up to speed with what happened just yesterday. An assistant county administrator refused to answer questions from state auditors, even though those auditors had a subpoena in hand. The Clay County attorney would not allow the administrator to answer the questions. The result, the state auditor will now have to take Clay County back to court for a second time. What's all this about?
So as I read the press release, and this was a press release that, by the way, is unsigned. We don't necessarily know who sent this out. It says only from the offices of Clay County government. So who is sending these out, we don't necessarily know. But this press release basically said that the assistant county administrator, Nicole Brown, who is, by the way, the custodian of record, showed up to be deposed in the state audit. But it was a non-attorney, or it wasn't an attorney that was going to be deposing her. And so according to this statement, they balked at that. And they said it should only be an attorney that is allowed to quote-unquote practice law and do this. And so they had big questions about whether or not this was lawful for the state auditor to be doing this.
And just to be clear, Nicole Brown, the assistant administrator up there, had failed to appear for a deposition also in response to a subpoena just a couple of weeks ago, right?
Correct. And she said in that case, she had notified the state auditor of a previously scheduled vacation day on the date of her actual subpoena to appear. But the very next day, she was there at the county commission, one of those specially called county commission meetings on a Tuesday. So so some big questions there.
You know, Aviva, State Auditor Nicole Galloway says at point blank in her comments that Clay County is unwilling to cooperate with the audit that's going on. Does she have a point?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, especially when it comes to the closed meeting notes. I think that's probably been the biggest area of contention. And yeah, there is a fight over whether or not to hand that over. The county has argued that the closed meeting notes contain attorney-client privileges or attorney-client privilege communication.
Right.
And that kind of those closed meeting notes get at kind of the heart of some of the concerns, which is, you know, what's happening behind closed doors, you know, not during open commission meetings.
Mm-hmm. What does the county say then in response to this notion that the county's being uncooperative when it comes to working with the state auditor to complete this audit that Clay County citizens have asked for?
Yeah, the county says, you know, they're complying with the bulk of the requests. Most of the information they're handing over, you know, it's just these closed meeting notes that they want clarification. And they say when they're going to the court, they're just asking for, you know, clarification on whether or not they have to hand over all of this and, you know, some of the concerns with attorney-client privilege communications.
Do you think that's true? Is the county cooperating with the bulk of these requests as far as you can tell?
I mean, the audit started last year, right? December 2018. We're still here discussing it. And there's been a lot of roadblocks along that way. You know,
it shouldn't take this long is your point.
Right. I mean, the commission filed a lawsuit very soon after the audit was announced to, you know, question whether or not the auditor was overstepping her authority. That lawsuit was dismissed.
Wow. Okay, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about the controversy over a state audit and other issues up in Clay County. We're joined by Matt Fleener from KMBC and Aviva Okeson-Haberman here from KCUR. Let's walk through some other issues here, Matt, beyond the slow walking of the audit. There's another lawsuit going on up there, this one involving the jail, and charges that the jail budget was dramatically underfunded. And it was underfunded, it's been alleged, as retaliation for an investigation the sheriff was conducting. Can you explain what that's about, Matt?
Yeah, the investigation stems back to 2017, an investigation of Assistant County Administrator Lori Portwood. And it was found that she had tampered with some documents, basically cutting a signature of the presiding commissioner off of some documents. And the sheriff opened the investigation, handed that over to the Missouri Highway Patrol. And somewhere along the line, there's been allegations that underfunding the budget, underfunding the sheriff's budget, was done in retaliation for that initial opening of the investigation of that document tampering back in 2017.
Does that charge of retaliation, is that plausible based on the reporting you've done?
You know, a lot of people have alleged that the sheriff, most notably, has alleged retaliation, and courts have found, including the Western District Appeals Court, just found that as well. They wrote that in their opinion that that there was some sort of retaliation here for underfunding the sheriff's budget.
I was going to say this issue has gone to the appeals court, and the appeals court said what you just said it did. Aviva, you want to hop in here?
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, I think you can look at the defense of the county in the appeals court decision. You know. In court, the lawyer representing the two commissioners didn't dispute that this was retaliation. That wasn't the county's argument. The county's argument is that elected officials can make budget decisions and that the court shouldn't be stepping in on this.
Hmm. What do Commissioners Owen and Ridgway say in response to this retaliation charge, Matt?
So it's hard to pin him down on it, especially Gene Owen. He is notorious for not speaking to the public. It took us 4 months to actually get an interview with him, a sit-down interview with him. So and he basically gave up talking to us. So I've emailed him every single time asking for a comment. So Gene Owen is hard to pin down on this. Lou Anne Ridgway, on the other hand, continues to fight. She doesn't believe that there was any sort of retaliation here. And, you know, she will respond. She will respond mostly via email to me. There are some times where I've been able to pin her down on camera. But yeah, she, you know, she continues to say, hey, there was no retaliation.
The county sheriff's office, meantime, just lost nearly $300,000 in federal funding because the county didn't submit an audit by the November 15th deadline. Can you explain what this is about, Aviva?
Yeah. It's slightly separate. So there's an outside auditing agency, RSM, that should be doing this audit. It's fairly routine. And from my understanding, RSM has said, you know, we can't do this audit because of the ongoing state audit. Auditor Nicole Galloway sent a letter saying, you know, no other county that she's been auditing has had this issue. RSM has declined to comment, saying, you know, they can't comment on client matters. But because there wasn't this just kind of basic audit done, the sheriff lost this grant funding. And the question is, does this jeopardize other federal grants that the county has? In 2017, the county had about $2 million in federal grant funding.
So you look at the loss of this money, you look at the cost of litigation here up there, you're topping easily $500,000, maybe beginning to approach $1 million. And in a county, an average-sized county like Clay County, that's real money, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. There are so many questions about these legal fees, right? There are so many questions about how they continue to pile up and why they continue to pile up. And it seems like the multiple lawsuits that are going on, citizens have said they are just absolutely not necessary. They're not necessary, but somehow they have found some legal arguments, some very narrow legal arguments to continue on appeal and continue to rack up these legal fees and ultimately cost taxpayers.
I want to talk about a couple more issues, then talk about what citizens, what recourse they might have here. There's another issue here, and that's this talk from Commissioner Ridgway about changing the structure of county government up in Clay County. What does she want to do, Aviva, and how is her idea being received?
Yeah, so a charter form of government, and what that looks like is really up in the air, and there's a few things going on in this front. So she created a committee that is going to kind of come up with some recommendations for this, and then it's also on the April ballot. And what voters,
it is going to be on the April ballot?
Yeah. And so what voters... Oh,
we don't even know what it is yet, though, right?
Right. So what voters will decide on in April is if they want to go with the first step of this, which means that a separate committee would be appointed by a judge that would actually write up what this looks like.
So instead of having three commissioners, the structure might be different. You might have five or seven commissioners?
You might have more commissioners, which the idea is that this helps address some of the infighting we're seeing.
Right.
You also could have some of the elected officials go to appointed officials, you know, maybe the assessor, collector are now appointed instead of elected.
Can you tell, Matt, are citizens interested in exploring this idea, or is it being criticized?
I think they are. I mean, I think there are some out there that say, yes, we do need to explore a change in the government. But in the way in which they came to this process of this committee before the committee has been questioned, right? A lot of people have questioned Luann Ridgway's even need to put this committee together. And so there's a little bit of distrust, I think, right, in this committee's process. At the same time, though, the committee is going ahead and working toward these questions of, hey, should it be 5 commissioners? Should it be 7 commissioners? What should our county government look like into the future?
Because on one level, it would seem to me that if you expand the number of commissioners, you might, in fact, get away from this notion that just 2 commissioners can create the level of controversy we've seen up there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think you're spot on. I mean, I think the questions are about the motives of Commissioner Ridgway, and I think that has clouded a lot of the discussion, is just people's personal feelings about her performance, and you know, what exactly this new form of government would look like. I mean, that really, the committee she's helped create, I mean, doesn't really have a say in that. It's going to be this separate committee that a judge appoints.
Okay, all the controversy in Clay County. We're wondering what citizens up there are thinking. 816-235-2888. Patricia from Gladstone, you're on Up to Date, Patricia.
Yes, hello. I was been trying to obtain the information from Clay County directly when the current presiding commissioner's terms expire. And I've tried for the past 3 weeks, excuse me, leaving a message on Nicole Brown's line, who the staff tell me she's the only one that can provide the information, and I have never received a call back. So I just wondered if your guest could maybe elaborate on that or have that information.
Good question, Patricia. I was going to go there in a few minutes. Do we know when the commissioner's terms expire here and folks would have a chance to elect, either reelect or elect new people?
So Commissioner Ridgway and Commissioner Owen's seats are up for a vote in 2020.
Oh, okay. So there's a chance here to make a change if citizens feel so inclined here.
Right. Yeah. I think that vote will be really interesting. And I mean, it's going to determine what the commission looks like going forward.
Are some folks talking about running against them, Aviva?
Yeah, there have been a number of people that have already filed. So the race will be competitive.
Okay. And I gather that they have staggered terms. Commissioner Nolte's term is, a couple years down the road?
Yeah,
perhaps?
It's not up for a vote in 2020, from my understanding.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. Aviva, your stories on Clay County also address how citizens themselves are feeling about their county government these days. What did they tell you?
So there are a number of concerns. I mean, going back to this discussion about just the amount of money that's spent on the lawsuit, I think that is a big concern is, you know, citizens wanted this audit, and now the commission is fighting this in court, spending taxpayer money on attorneys to fight this in court. Mm-hmm. You know, another concern is just the amount that's being spent defending these cuts to the sheriff, you know, in court.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of concerns about how money is being spent and also just kind of some of the transparency within the commission.
Is recall of some of these commissioners a possibility? Is that even an option?
It is not an option under state law right now. There's been push. Huh. There's been push in the state legislature to change that, but there's also been push back from the current administrators and Commissioner Ridgway and Commissioner Owen to basically fight that that bill moving forward in the state house to recall these county commissioners.
And this is a bill that's actually been sponsored by a lawmaker from Clay County,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's right. Multiple lawmakers from Clay County have joined in on this, and there's been plenty of lobbying efforts. Clay County also has a lobbying budget to make sure that this law doesn't move forward. So,
boy, lots of controversy for a medium-sized county like we have here in our neck of the woods in Clay County. I want to thank our guests for a good conversation here. That was the voice of Matt Fleener, an investigative reporter and anchor at KMBC-TV. Aviva Okeson-Haberman also joined us. She's KCUR's Missouri reporter. Thank you both for your good reporting and for coming on today. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After a short break, we'll put a jazzy spin on some holiday classics with Mark Meyer, one of my favorite guests here from the Jazz Wax blog. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske, feeling a void from the recent lack of up-to-date episodes because impeachment hearings have so rudely taken us off the air. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter at kcur.org/Kraske and find out what we've been working on here. It's called Kraske Off Mic, and you should subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. Next week on the show, a Bush-era law says insurance companies should cover mental health care the same way they treat physical care. But Missouri isn't enforcing it. On Wednesday, we'll find out who's at risk and how mental health parity is being addressed. Holiday music? We've all got our favorites. But what about a jazzy take on holiday music? Question one might well be, does the idea of putting a jazzy spin on holiday classics agree with you, or does it rub you the wrong way? But if it does work, then the list of possibilities grows dramatically because jazz greats have been reinterpreting holiday standards for decades. I've got my pick, you'll hear it in just a few minutes, and Mark Myers, the curator of the award-winning Jazz Wax website, has a batch of good picks that we'll be running through during the next 30 minutes. And we're going to be hearing from Karen Allison, Diana Panton, Julie London, Bill Evans, and Julie Christie, and you're not going to be disappointed. Mark Myers is a regular arts and culture contributor at the Wall Street Journal, where he writes the Anatomy of a Song and House Call columns. His daily jazzwax.com blog is a three-time winner of the Jazz Journalists Association's Blog of the Year Award. He's the author of best-selling books, Anatomy of a Song and Why Jazz Happened, and he currently is completing an oral history of the rock concert from 1950 to 1985. That'll be coming out next year. Mark, it's always great to have you on the show. Welcome back.
Steve, thanks for having me. Great to hear your voice.
Any idea which jazz artists were among the first to come out with holiday albums, Mark?
It's probably in the pop department, but I think, you know, if you go back, Charlie Parker recorded White Christmas.
That's right.
And I'm sure there are others who sort of worked it in. But again, that's the single era. It's not the album era yet. Everything was on 78, so a compilation really wasn't the mindset of the record companies then.
You know, so back when Charlie Parker was coming out with an album like White Christmas, did some folks around the country object to the idea of putting a jazz spin on these classic recordings?
Now, that's the beauty of this music. Everybody can jump in and twist it and turn it and spin it any way they wish. The essence, of course, is the melody and the spirit of the season. But anyone with a sort of a hip mindset can dig the sound of this. It's the tradition, but it's also giving it a little bit of play.
There are so many holiday albums out there, you know, jazz or any other genre for that matter. That makes it awfully hard to pick just a handful of songs, doesn't it, Mark?
It does. It does. Which is why, you know, what I thought would be kind of cool would be to bring along some songs that are off the beaten trail, really very little known holiday songs, not the usual stuff you hear, but great jazzy jazzy holiday music, but that's really stuff that you're not familiar with.
Well, let's go to your picks here. Your first artist is Diana Panton, and a lot of people have probably not heard of her. Who was she, Mark?
Diana lives up in Hamilton, Ontario. She wrote the lyrics to the song we're going to hear, and Don Thompson wrote the music. Don played with George Shearing, most notably, and Jim Hall. But it's a song that she wrote. It's recent, 2013, but it just sounds like it's been around forever, and it's just wonderful. I think you're going to love it.
Well, this is Christmas Kiss from Diana Panton.
Snowflakes fall, cold winds blow, outside it's winter white, and there's nowhere else I'd rather be tonight. The kids upstairs are in their beds, all tucked in warm and tight. this Christmas Eve with a Christmas kiss. And as we snuggle by the fire, we'll share a dream or two.
Mark, that is really nice. Diana Panton.
Isn't that sweet?
Christmas Kiss.
Yeah, yeah. The inspiration for the lyrics, Diana told me, it was an image of her parents sitting by the fireplace when she was little, taking a Christmas break, taking a break from all the action. Yeah, it's sweet. And her latest album is A Cheerful Little Earful, which also is equally gentle, equally reassuring, and shows off her beautiful voice.
I'm not sure if you wrote this or somebody else did, but somebody wrote, with a purr as smooth as whipped eggnog, Panton makes Christmas Kiss a sprig of audio mistletoe. Boy, what a great line that is, too.
It is.
Is that yours?
No, not me.
That came from somebody else, yeah, okay.
I don't think so. Yeah, it doesn't come to mind.
Well, your second pick here is someone you've written a lot about on the Jazz Wax website, and she's a classic in her own right, Julie London. You're a huge fan of hers. You've written so much about her, and she really was extraordinary.
Yeah, the interesting thing here is that she only recorded one Christmas side. She didn't do an album. She didn't do two sides. Only recorded one Christmas side. And it was written by her then husband, Bobby Troup.
Mm-hmm.
This is in 1957. The orchestra and chorus are conducted by Johnny Mann. And it's just fascinating to hear. And you sort of wonder, why in heaven's name didn't she record an entire... Why didn't Liberty Records get her to record an entire album?
You know, folks roughly our age might recall her from the Emergency TV show back in, what, the 60s or early 70s?
And the nurse.
She was sultry. She was smoky voice. She was a TV star. And she was a recording star, too. And I want to read you something from the All Music Guide. They wrote this: London never had the range of Ella Fitzgerald or Sarah Vaughan, but often used restraint, softness, and subtlety to maximum advantage. Does that make sense to you, Mark?
Yeah, and it's to me, she had the most with it voice that was powdery and sultry. It just knocks you out as soon as you hear it.
What's a track you picked here?
The only track she ever recorded, her only holiday track, is called I'd Like You for Christmas, again by her then-husband, words and music, Bobby Troup.
Let's listen to Julie London.
Christmas, please make my wish come true, 'cause
That's Julie London. I'd like you for Christmas. We're going to conduct a poll here this afternoon in Kansas City. What percentage of Kansas Cityans would let Julie London have them for Christmas? And I bet the number would be pretty high. You know, she was married, Mark, once to, I think her first husband was Jack Webb of Dragnet fame, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
And I read that.
But just the hippest sound, right, Steve?
No kidding. Yeah. Despite her fame, she said to be surprisingly shy when she was alive.
Yeah, she was. She had a stunning look. Her eyes were very wide set. She really could deliver. She's just a wonderful actress and a terrific singer. The wonderful thing about her is it doesn't bring it on strong. It's subtle. It's powdery.
Yes.
But she has a sixth gear that she throws it into, and that voice, it can hold notes, and it goes up high and comes down low, and there's no flaw, but it's incredibly, incredibly hip.
We're reviewing some maybe not so well-known Christmas songs with Mark Myers of Jazz Wax fame. Anatomy of a Song is one of his recent books. Let's move on here to June Christie, somebody else that will be well-known to us folks of a certain generation, but maybe has been lost to time a little bit.
Yeah, this is off an album. Again, this is Off the Beaten Trail Christmas Songs. This Time of Year is the name of it, and it has a wonderful cover of June sort of throwing a snowball at the photographer. This particular song we're going to hear is The Merriest from 1961. It was written by Connie Pierce and Arnold Miller. They were married. And the interesting thing is, after they wrote all the music and all the lyrics and the music for this particular album, This Time of Year for Christie, they disappeared. You can't find them. It's almost as if they only wrote this stuff and then they went back to becoming emergency room doctors or whatever it is that they did. There's just no trace of them.
How popular was June Christie back in her time?
Very popular,
yeah,
on Capitol
say.
Records. Yeah, Pete, this song we're going to hear is arranged and conducted by Pete Rugolo, who was with Stan Kenton and a big presence in the Capitol catalog. But June recorded many, many pop songs. She was probably the hippest of the best-known pop singers, more hip than Peggy Lee, more California than Ella. Her sound was just very L.A., very Hollywood in the 1950s.
I always got her mixed up with Anita O'Day.
Yeah, Anita O'Day had a pluckier sense of humor, sort of a wet towel snapping kind of sense of humor, Anita O'Day. But June was more restrained, but drier. There's a drier sound to her voice, but very, very in the know.
Let's listen to June Christie, this track, The Merriest, from the album This Time of the Year.
I'd like to fix this bag of tricks and hand them out with a fleeting greeting. Smiles for the frowners, salutes to the uppers, boosts for the downers. May the day be the bowl of cherriest, and to all the merriest, hope you swing during the season. Hope the days go great, hope you find plenty of reason the whole year long to celebrate. Sun for the mopers, a laugh for the criers, luck to the hopers, to the strange and the ordinariest, me to you, the merriest. Thoughts for the muses, a cheer for the winners, breaks for the losers, to the beats and the debonairiest. Greetings like the merriest, hope there's ore under your rose vine, hope you get that raise, hope you hope everything goes fine the next 300 and some odd days. Friends for the loners, a song for the singers, grins for the groaners, make the day nothing can compare, yes. Have the most, the merriest.
Boy, that's fun, Mark. Love that track.
Yeah, if you're not snapping your finger to
Huh? Yeah, can't help but move to that. June Christie, the track again, The Merriest, from the album This Time of the Year. Let's move on here to another artist we wanted to spotlight who did a Christmas song that maybe isn't as well known today as maybe it should be. Bill Evans, the great jazz pianist, is who you wanted to spotlight here. You're a huge fan of his, Mark, and you wonder sometimes why more people aren't.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Evans recorded Santa Claus Is Coming to Town a couple of times, but just piano. And in Stockholm in 1964, while the trio was recording behind Monica Zetterlund, the Swedish pop singer, on her album Waltz for Debbie, at the very end, he recorded a vocal singing Santa Claus Is Coming to Town. In fact, he recorded it twice. I don't think they quite got it on the first take, and they wanted a second take. The reason this is so rare is that it was never released on the album when it came out on Philips. And only in 2008, when the Japanese issued it on CD, did they find these extra takes and added it. So it's only available in Japan. Most people have never heard it before, but it's Bill Evans with a great sense of humor who was coaxed into singing Santa Claus Is Coming to Town and released in 64.
Let's check it out.
You ready? You better not shout, you better not cry, you better not pout, 'cause I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Better not shout, better not cry, gonna find out who's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees when you are sleeping, he knows when you're awake. When you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. Better not shout, better not cry, better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to. All right?
I'm sorry, you take two.
Okay, take two now.
Having difficulty with the vibrato.
You know, I'm going to do this once, man. You better get it. Yeah, you're throwing.
I thought that you had written lyrics.
Okay? We're rolling. Okay, silence. Ready? You better not shout, my, 'cause Santa Claus is coming.
Well, I think we know now why Bill Evans stuck to the piano as much as he did, Mark.
Yeah, and I realize why we're listening to that first attempt, why that wasn't used and why the second wasn't used. He blew the lyrics twice.
But it's interesting
but it's
to
remarkable.
See.
It's just a wonderful. You get insight into his sense of humor. You know, there's this lightness to it. You know, he always felt lighter in Europe. He always felt more at home and more at ease. When I spoke with Chuck Israels yesterday, by the way, who's the bassist on there, I asked him what prompted Bill to record that. He said, you know, his memory was cloudy, but he said he thinks Bill had sung it before and someone had heard it, and then they sort of coaxed him or asked him to do it again.
You know, just to put Bill Evans on the map for some people out there, Miles Davis absolutely loved him. Miles picked him to play on the best-selling jazz disc of all time, which is Kind of Blue. And why did Miles Davis pick Bill Evans for that, Mark?
Bill at the time was enormously sophisticated. In other words, he was at the same level as Miles in terms of the execution and in terms of the depth, the deepness of it. So you hear that when you listen to his recordings. You also hear it in Live at the Plaza with the same group when he's famously playing on Green Dolphin Street. Mm-hmm. It's just a wonderful piano solo. You know, you've got Coltrane, you've got Miles. It's just a wonderful, wonderful group. But Bill, I guess, and Wynton Kelly were the only ones at that sophisticated level at that time.
But you can't help but notice that Bill Evans was something of a tortured soul at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, he struggled terribly with narcotic issues from the late 50s on, and some people have you know, told me that this really started with the Miles Davis group, that those who were addicted in the Miles Davis group had hooked him. But at the same time, Bill was, you know, I think he suffered from depression, and many times people think of jazz musicians as people getting high. But my interviews, what came out, which was interesting, is that they're really self-medicating for depression at a time when the medications we have today for depression and mental illness don't exist. So it was really a lot of that was self-medication. They felt better when they took this stuff. Unfortunately, it went downhill from there.
I was going to say, you were involved in the release of a 2017 album of a freshly discovered Bill Evans performance at the Netherlands Radio Union. How did that project come together?
Resonance is a gorgeous, really gorgeous label. Zev Feldman, who is the producer there, knows, you know, how deep I am into Bill Evans, and was kind enough to have me do the liner notes for, I guess maybe it was two or three of the releases, Bill Evans releases. But it's fascinating to hear the mood that Bill sort of divides into these categories over the years, and, you know, tortured poet or hyperactive, you know, cocaine use. You know, right. It's just you hear these different periods of Bill. But the tapes were found over there in the Netherlands, and they were in great shape. The thing over there is that the government sponsors radio stations and often musicians. But when Bill was over there, he did quite a bit of recording on radio stations, and they had preserved it.
Well, I want to play my pick for a little-known holiday jazz tune, and I want to pick an artist who's got deep Kansas City connections, doesn't live here any longer, but Karn Allison. I just have been an admirer of her music for so many years. This song is This Time of Year, and it's from her 2013 album, Yuletide Hideaway.
This time of year, snowflakes fall and children's eyes reflect the magic light that warms us all. The world's alive with reds and greens, and we can all share in the special gifts that Christmas brings. Carol sung this time of year brings back the thoughts of special times we've spent with one so dear. A crackling fire, some mistletoe.
That's Karn Allison from her album Yuletide Hideaway. Mark, before you run, you have this book coming out next year, The Oral History of the Rock Concert. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I spent 2 years interviewing more than 60 people, tracking from 1950 to 1985, the evolution of this thing called the rock concert. It's, you know, rock concert is a special thing, and it's disappearing very, very quickly as the electric guitar disappears. But the way that the concert evolves, the way its political overtones, the way it began as a sort of a brushing off of one's parents in the mid-50s, and then becomes the music of civil rights and that struggle. And then by the time you get to the 1960s, it's big. The rock is centrally located in the middle of the peace movement, and then, you know, divides into many categories in the 1970s. And by Live Aid, the rock concert has affected several generations. It's where everybody can remember their first concert.
Right.
Everybody can remember, you know, what bands they loved. Everybody remembers the album covers. Mark, rock was more than music for a generation.
I got to scoot. Mark Myers, Wall Street Journal fame, his new book coming out next fall. Always a pleasure, Mark. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you, Steve. Thank you.
You bet. Next week on the show, we'll sit down with the new owner of the Kansas City Royals. That's John Sherman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.
And if you ever saw it.